Hi, you're listening to the International Risk Podcast. We hear from the traditional to the wacky. Your host, Dominic Bowen, will ask the questions that you all want the answers to. If you know Dominic, then you know that he is well acquainted with risk. Joined by our excellent guests, he'll reveal innovative ideas on how you can ensure your organisation thrives in areas with high risk.
Hi, I'm Dominic, host of the International Risk Podcast. Recently, we heard from Petra Molnar on episode 156 about some of the risks related to modern immigration technologies, artificial intelligence, and risks for refugees. This week, we'll be continuing this important discussion about people who are displaced. Last year, the United Nations estimated that there's about 110 million people displaced around the world, and this includes about 36.5 million refugees. There's a rising number of people fleeing persecution, violence, human rights violations, and of course, there's also the negative impacts of climate change, disasters, geopolitics, and increasingly extreme politics. And more people around the world are in need of international protection. It's important to note, though, that 3/4 of the world's refugee population, that's about 76% of the refugees around the world, have actually sought refuge in neighbouring countries, in low and middle income countries, particularly countries near where the refugees are actually from. Now, the risks that refugees face are vast, often being displaced for many years at a time, to facing significant discrimination and marginalisation when seeking safety in another country. In order for us to help unpack this large topic and to understand the international risks to refugees, to host populations, and to everyone watching from the sidelines, we're thrilled to be joined today by Laurie Wilkinson. Laurie is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Manitoba. Her research centres on the economic and social outcomes of immigrants and refugees, with a special focus on women and youth. She also volunteers with several international, national, and local community organisations who are working towards the successful resettlement of newcomers. Welcome to the International Risk Podcast, Laurie.
Thanks for having me on, Dominic.
Well, in 2017, you published a report about the economic integration of refugees in Canada. In this report, you suggested that integration and achieving self-sufficiency of new arrivals will be a major challenge. Could you explain why the integration process is such a challenge and perhaps where we are today in Canada with integration and self-sufficiency several years on from this report?
Well, if you can imagine the travel that our refugees need to make, not only across borders and continents, but the time that it takes to get to their new destination, you'll come to understand that the economic integration of refugees takes a little while. So the average refugee spends at least 7 years, if not more, in a refugee camp or outside their country of origin before they ever get to a place where they're permanently resettled. So many of the refugees that come have extreme gaps in their education and work experience. And so this holds them back in, you know, getting a job and settling into the new economy. In Canada, at least, only 3 out of 10 refugees actually arrive to the country knowing some English or some French. And also not knowing the language of the place that you're moving to also affects the time and the speed and the quality of integration. And then if you think, I've got credentials, I've got a diploma, I've got a degree, I've got work experience. One of the favorite tactics of people in war is to destroy all of those records. And so your university, your post-secondary education, it may no longer exist, and neither do those records exist. And so it makes it hard for the new employers to verify that you actually have a diploma or that you have work experience, right? Maybe your old boss is dead, or you can't find your boss, or you can't find people to corroborate your work experience. And so all of that adds up to a fairly rocky first 2 to 7 years for most refugees in terms of resettling economically.
Isn't that interesting? We often see the big ticket issues. We know in Australia, the UK, US, social integration is such a huge issue. You know, the language barriers you mentioned, the cultural differences, and sometimes, sadly, the community resistance or even just outright xenophobia is a big issue. We know that finding employment is difficult. But as you said, it was really interesting that, you know, sometimes we forget the basics that most of us can prove quite easily where we did our master's or our undergrad degree. We can prove through our referees what our previous jobs were. Those companies all still exist. But as you said, in many countries, because of war or conflict, maybe the companies or our former employees just simply don't exist anymore. And it's almost impossible to prove.
And added to that, so some people, they're given mere minutes to flee. And so what do you take when you have 2 minutes in your house and somebody's got a gun telling you to get out? You don't think to take your diploma or degree, or you don't think to take a picture of that stuff. So you don't even have photographic evidence that you've attained these great accomplishments. And so you lose that along the way. And then it becomes easier for employers in Canada to say, well, I don't really believe that you have a university degree, so I'm not going to consider you for this type of work.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. And I know, and I understand, that your research is focused on the economic and social outcomes of immigrants and refugees, especially women and the youth. Now, given that women and youth populations often face unique challenges during displacement, can you elaborate on the intersection of risks that these two groups encounter and how they might differ from the general refugee population?
Sure. So Canada's not so different from Australia, the United Kingdom, or the United States, where about 60% of refugees arrive before their 29th birthday. Literally means that for the young people, most of them will have had some educational touch, right? Whether it's they've had to redo or enter high school, maybe they've entered post-secondary education or had some sort of touch with the education system. Now, the prevailing belief amongst employers and governments is as well, if you've got a Canadian education, then your transition to the labor market actually should be fairly seamless. But there's problems here. So imagine, back to the point that I made about the average refugee is about 7 years in a refugee camp. For young people, if you enter a refugee camp at age 7, you come out at age 14 and arrive in Canada, you've got a 7-year gap in your primary education. And in most of the provinces in Canada, one has to graduate from high school either before your 19th birthday or before your 21st birthday. So there's interprovincial differences here. But even for the refugee who enters at age 14, who is in a province that allows them to go to high school till they're age 21, they're going to have a really hard time finishing high school, especially if they don't know English or French upon arrival. So the risk here that we're seeing in Canada is that young people who come kind of in those teenage years, who have language gaps, who have education gaps, are pushed out of the regular system. Now, there's some educational opportunities for young adults, but not many. Usually they're full. And so then you have a bunch of people who are not employed or they're not employable and they don't have a full education. And so you've got a group of people who's in danger of becoming impoverished or to get into trouble. And if we don't look after them as a society, we're going to be in big trouble because this group of people could otherwise be actively engaged in labor market and in society if we give them a chance at such a young age. For adult women, the issue is a little bit different. So many adult women, I just did a study with the Yazidi refugees, and many of those women came to Canada not knowing where their husband was or missing children. So part of the conflict there is that ISIS had kidnapped a bunch of the women, had sexually assaulted them. We brought them to Canada and bits and pieces of their family were lost. Many of these women lost their husbands, but they still have hope that their husband is still alive and that they could be eventually reunited. But being separated and not knowing the fate of your loved ones causes significant distress. And for some women, it becomes difficult to learn the language because you're distressed about your child or your husband. And it becomes near impossible to enter the labor market if you don't have language and you're distressed. And so you have this kind of family reunification problem that's layered on top of all of the other challenges that refugees face when they move to a new nation.
And so, you know, when we look at these risks to refugees and communities, you know, you talk about the risk of course, poverty. If people are unable to complete their education, if they're unable to become integrated into the mainstream workforce, what are some of the other risks to the refugee populations and even to the host communities if we don't get integration right? If displaced people live, people seeking refuge in Canada, America, the UK, and not able to be integrated into the host populations and become positive contributors? What are the risks to them and to the host communities?
So to the individual, the risk is highly psychological. So imagine you put all of this work into getting a post-secondary education, you get good grades, you work really hard, and then you're displaced and you're told that that education is not worth anything. This phenomenon, there's a paper written about it about 10 years ago from Statistics Canada called Who Drives a Taxi in Canada? And it's very interesting. About 25% of all taxi cab drivers have a bachelor's or a post-secondary level of education that's higher than a bachelor's degree. And so you have something that's called underemployment and overeducated. And so can you imagine, like, you spend all that time, you know, maybe you're studying to be a vet, and you spend all that time learning about the anatomy and the physiology of all of these animals that you're going to treat. And then you come to Canada and you're told you can't practice. And so the only way that you can make your family, you know, feel afloat and house them and clothe them and feed them is to, you know, take a job that's well beneath your skill set. So for the individual family, that hurts a lot. It hurts psychologically, it hurts the family. But from a social perspective, in Canada, we have a shortage of vets. And so there isn't a lot of effort in Canada until recently. So the pandemic kind of changed a few of these rules. But, you know, until recently, it was almost impossible to be a vet in Canada if you were trained abroad. And so the country suffers because we have a shortage of vets. We have a shortage of physicians, because I can apply this story to physicians, to nurses, to anybody in the healthcare field. So we have these shortages in Canada and qualified people to work in this area, and their whole population suffers, right? Like, so from a health perspective, people wait longer for diagnostics. There's people without family doctors. And I understand that there needs to be language training and perhaps a bit of cultural training with people, especially in the healthcare sector. But that training isn't like 7 years or 10 years. And you're letting a bunch of people sit otherwise idle or doing work that's well beneath their training when Canadians are also suffering because we have this shortage of healthcare workers and vets and other people.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You know, there's obviously the financial strain and the lost opportunity for the families where people do have fantastic qualifications and skills. But of course, over time, and as you said, you've potentially been in a refugee camp for 7 or more years, there's the skill atrophy. But then the mental health issues, knowing that you could be doing so much more, and not just for your own family and financially contributing, but the risk that poses to the economy, the host population, that you could be really contributing so much more than what you otherwise are. So you can certainly see the job dissatisfaction, the wage loss, the economic costs, and then of course all of that leading to the psychological impacts. So what are and what have you seen as some effective strategies for promoting better economic integration of refugees within host countries, particularly in terms of employment opportunities and even entrepreneurial support, which certainly we see a lot of refugees in host countries, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Turkey, just doing amazing things. Even in Bangladesh, the million Rohingya that were displaced from Burma into Bangladesh. I mean, the entrepreneurial spirit was just amazing from so many of these communities. So what have you seen as being some of the most effective strategies for encouraging positive integration?
So 4 provinces in Canada have created something called the Office of the Fairness Commissioner. These are about 10 years old. And in Canada, the regulated professions, such as physicians, nurses, vets, they are all fall under the auspices of their professional association. And their professional association kind of sets the criteria for accepting or rejecting training activities and classes that you need to take. The Office of the Fairness Commissioner tries to work with these organizations to make the assessments more fair. So in the case of pre-pandemic, in order to become a dentist in Canada, it was really, really difficult because you'd have to complete 4 practical exams with patients having certain dental features that you need to fix, right? Like something from a filling all the way to a root canal, right? And you'd have to pass these exams, which were monitored and expensive too. And also across the country, Canada's a big country. Your root canal exam might be taking place in Edmonton and you live all the way over in Halifax, which I think is kind of like flying from Paris to Moscow, maybe even a bit further. Plus you have to fly the patient out or arrange a patient that needs a root canal and is willing to be your exam participant. And that would cost thousands of dollars and take years of practice and passing exams in order to make it. The Office of the Fairness Commissioner has worked with dental organizations to try to like streamline this process because it is a little bit ridiculous. If I need a root canal, I'm usually going to get a root canal in the same way if I have it in India versus if I have it in Canada. And I can speak from personal experience, not from dental, but from medical scares, because I had to visit a hospital in India and I got exactly the same kind of care that I would get in Canada. So you can't tell me that, you know, the medical profession or the dental profession is so different in all of these countries that, you know, person has to start from scratch to take their training over again. Many of the provinces have also tried to open up more spots for physicians to do their internship in Canada so that they can be licensed as well. Because previously there'd be like 5 spots available in certain provinces, yet there'd be thousands of people who were trying to fill those spots. And as an anecdote, Canadians who are trained as physicians abroad fight for those few spots as well. And so now we have a bunch of Canadians that are qualified that can't practice in Canada because they can't get an intern spot. So, you know, you have all the economic losses in that regard, but then you have the health losses too. I can actually talk about some entrepreneurial stuff too. So there's some companies in Canada that have made it a mission to hire refugees. And probably one of the most important examples is Danby Electronics in Southern Ontario. So they don't exclusively hire refugees, but they make it a point to hire refugees. They understand that the refugees that they hire probably won't stay around for a long time because they're highly trained people and will move on. But they pay them a good wage, give them Canadian work experience so that it gives them a leg up the next time that they apply. And so the owner of Danby Electronics has been recognized with several awards for the work that he's done in employing refugees, and other companies have begun to follow suit. On smaller scales, some refugee organizations such as hirearefugee.org will also bring people together and help place people into different kinds of jobs. They're not generally great jobs, but it's enough for them to get Canadian experience, which is what increasingly some employers require as a form of not hiring an immigrant or a refugee.
We definitely saw that even during the ongoing Ukraine crisis with Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and the influx of Ukrainians, predominantly Ukrainian women, across Europe seeking refuge, particularly during the start of the crisis. And we saw very qualified, very skilled, very well-educated Ukrainian women unable to get basic jobs just because they didn't have the British or the Swedish experience, even though they were very, very qualified. But we certainly saw the companies, including my company, that did employ Ukrainians early on, that it was such a great decision. Such a great decision. And I think that could be replicated for any refugee community that arrives in Europe. Maybe in some cases, maybe in some professions, as you said, some cultural training, some integration. But, you know, that can be for people that are keen to learn, that shouldn't be a roadblock to moving forward. You and I were speaking earlier about some of the, you know, sometimes they're letters, sometimes it's social media, sometimes it's just rumors that start about all the money that refugees are getting and that they're getting so much more money than retirees or so much more money than people that have worked for their whole life in Australia or the US or UK. But I'd like to hear from you. How does financial services and even access to things like credit when refugees first arrive, how does this contribute to successful integration of refugees? And perhaps we should also, while we're talking about this, are there any big myths that are worth busting right here at the outset?
Well, I think when it comes to supporting refugees when they first arrive, it tends to be, and economists have looked at this more closely than I have, the more impactful investments come with not just the financial investments at the start, but also the community investments at the start. So if you can shorten the short-term and the medium-term integration problems with a refugee family, they are more successful faster in the long run. And so one of the myths that exists in Canada, but I kind of think it exists elsewhere, is that refugees are such a drain on the economy that they cost us so much money. Now, the truth of the matter is that at the initial resettlement phase, yeah, the costs of resettling a refugee are relatively expensive. However, because refugees arrive to Canada largely before their 30th birthday, they're going to have decades of labor market experience by the time they're ready to retire. And if you look at the income that they bring in and the taxes that they pay out, that actually exceeds the cost of resettling them in the first place. So one of the big myths is, oh, you know, refugees suck our welfare costs through the roof and they take all this money, when in fact, actually over a lifetime, they pay more in taxes than they ever take out in terms of any service. And that includes teaching them English or French, teaching them or bringing them through school, taking them through post-secondary education, and any of the housing costs that they accrue in their first couple of years in Canada.
Yeah, I've seen many studies related to this, some from far right and right think tanks, but the results are really consistent that yes, there is short-term financial pressure. There can be labor market integration challenges. There can be competition for low-skilled jobs. And you said there sometimes can be social and cultural integrations. On average, and in most cases, in the majority of cases, overall, there is labor market contributions. There is increased entrepreneurship and innovation. Of course, there's the fantastic things around cultural exchange and new skills. But there's also the demographic benefits that many Western countries are desperately suffering from, about these demographic bulges that are very negative and aging populations that refugee communities can actually positively contribute to. And then, of course, there's the basic increased demand for goods and services. So I think the research has been quite consistent that at its worst, there is zero net impact. And at its best, it's a very positive impact from an economic and cultural point of view. So
in Canada, it's 1.3 jobs that are created for each new refugee that arrives. And that's 1.3 jobs for Canadians, not for refugees. So the other aspect too is that there's some studies in some occupations that indicate that refugees are a competitor to Canadians for certain jobs, but they're usually for the low-skilled, low-pay type jobs. And what happens to the Canadians that are pushed out of those jobs is they're shifted actually into higher level, higher paid employment. At least that's what happened during the pandemic. Because of the labor market-wide shortage of people, people shifted and the Canadians tended to shift upwards rather than downwards.
So I guess it's quite similar to a lot of the fears about artificial intelligence. There will be some job losses, but most of those job losses will be to higher paid jobs and better jobs in many cases. I wonder, and you know, I'm from Australia originally, Laurie, and you know, Australia is such a multicultural country. I mean, some of our listeners have probably heard me say this before, that when I was in primary school, there were times when I was the only Aussie actually in the class. You know, there were the Syrians, there were the Chinese, there were the Timorese, there were the Greeks and the Italians. And it was such a fantastic, fantastic country to grow up in. But we still have significant, we being Australia, still have very, very significant integration challenges still to this day. And we've failed on so many occasions. It's a great country and, you know, we're trying hard, but Australia has made many, many mistakes when it comes to integrations. So I wonder from your studies and from what you've seen around the world, in what ways can local communities, can businesses, can local government be actively encouraging positive participation to increase integration of refugees, to foster that cultural and social cohesion, and to recognize the mutual benefit that new communities can bring to existing communities?
So I think governments can invest in their communities to organize activities and programs that bring people together. Because there's research to suggest that once you bring people together, they start to know one another, they start to engage with one another, they start to ask questions of one another, and they learn from one another. And so programs that actively try to engage that willingness of many people to get together and learn from one another are actually helpful. It's just hard to put a measurement into it, right? So in our neoliberal governments, they want to have charts and proof, numerical proof that something has happened. Well, integration, you can't put a number on it. You can't put a number on the friendships that develop and the connections that develop because you have an annual activities. Like right now, we're entering into Eid. How do you measure the participation and the learning and the knowledge and the getting together when we have these kind of community activities? Like you can't give somebody a survey and go, oh, how do you feel about, you know, participating in this activity? Did you make new friends? You don't do that at that moment. It's moment after moment after moment and year after year after year that you suddenly realize, oh, I have a more diverse set of friends and I've learned more about a different culture and I feel more comfortable with people in my own culture or outside of my own culture. And so finding a metric for that is, well, it's beyond me, but governments are you know, reluctant to put that kind of money into these activities because they can't measure them. But I think the other thing that we can think about, thinking about your example, right, going to school and learning about people who are different than you, I had the exact same experience in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. I grew up in the 1980s. One of my first friends was from Laos. I had no idea where Laos was. And people were telling me that my friend came over on a boat. For your listeners, Saskatchewan is a landlocked province. There's no way that my friend came to Saskatoon on a boat. So my 8-year-old mind was trying to figure out how she got here from all the way over the world. I looked up on the globe where she was from and why they were calling her a boat person. But that relationship, even though it lasted only 2 years because her family relocated 2 years after they arrived in my city, that experience touched me very much because we shared lunches together, literally. Like, she brought me stuff for lunch and I brought her stuff for lunch, and sometimes I liked it and sometimes I didn't. And same thing with her. My grandma knit her mittens, and I was just an average working class kid. And so I see in my students nowadays who are exposed to significantly more diversity than I ever was, are much more open to talking to one another, learning from one another, and not just about culture, but about religion, about sexuality. And I think at least some parts of Canadian society are doing this right, you know, getting their kids involved in learning about people who are different from them. We still have a group of people in Canada who refuse to allow their kids to, you know, travel in diverse circles. But I think you're going to find that in every place. But for the majority of students, they walk around in these circles that are much more free, much more open, and a lot less racist than it used to be 40 or 50 years ago. It's not perfect. Canada's full of warts. And we can talk about our Indigenous people and integrating Indigenous people and respecting their culture and our relationships. We're doing a terrible job, but at least we're starting that conversation, because racism and discrimination, those are civilian or civilization level problems that have existed since humans started being humans.
Yeah, they certainly are. On the International Risk Podcast, you know, we deliberately cover a really broad range of topics. And recently we had a discussion about the ongoing conflict in Israel and Palestine. We had a cybersecurity expert on to talk about the risks that business leaders should be aware of. We had a mafia expert come on and talk about the risks of transnational crime. We even had a professor come and talk to us about the risks and opportunities about seeking discomfort and personal growth. And then, of course, we had someone on recently talking about the Putin election, or the Russian election. And we do that deliberately because we see risk and international risk as something that really is multidisciplinary. And there's so much learning to be had across different spheres, even if it's not your daily bread and butter. And I know personally, I've found multidisciplinary teams to be really effective in tackling certain risks and certain challenges. In your work, and I'm wondering particularly about your work at the Immigration Research West, if you've been working with multidisciplinary teams and how this diverse experience has contributed to your understanding and perhaps the understanding of your teams about managing the risks and opportunities associated with refugee integration and what innovative solutions have come out of working in these multidisciplinary teams.
So I think you can't do refugee research in silos. And so as a sociologist, I look at the issue of refugees and war in a different way than my friends in political studies, in economics, in medicine, who I've worked with people from all kinds of disciplines trying to kind of crack this nut. So, you know, the danger for academics especially is getting too discipline specific, but also not including the community. So none of my research is done without talking to the community it affects. So I'm just wrapping up a survey of Afghan refugees who came to Canada. And from start to finish, the Afghan community was part of the project design, the collection of the data, the interpretation of the data, because I don't know everything about being an Afghan refugee. And the community actually provides some very important examples and experience for us researchers, because, well, I've never been a refugee either, right? So I learn significantly, not just from my peers on campus, but from the people who are working in the community and the communities themselves. Otherwise, you're kind of left with theoretical pieces, which might be correct and they're useful in their own way. But I'm kind of a researcher who likes to, I'm a practical researcher. I like to get in there and meet the people and answer the questions that they want me to answer. Because the other thing is I can come up with the questions that I want, but maybe answering those questions are not useful for the community at all. And so my goal with my students is to try to get them to think about, well, what does the community want and need? Because that kind of overrides what you academically want to need. But yes, the short answer is I've learned lots from everybody.
I think that's such a great point. And you know, you can use that everywhere. I use that as a management consultant. I'm working with business leaders every day. And it's very easy for me to fall into the trap of knowing what they need to know, when sometimes I do need to catch myself and just go, actually, maybe I should just go back to the client, just double check. What is it that you need support with?
Yeah.
You've brought me in as the expert, but what do you think you need? Where do you want that support? Going back to basics is often nearly always a really good idea. But we always ask everyone on the International Risk Podcast, Laurie, what, when they look around the world, and for you, what, when you look around the world, what are the risks that concern you the most?
I think rising economic inequality is one. The pandemic really increased the distance between the haves and the have-nots. And so that's why not only are refugee movements becoming larger, immigration movements are becoming larger too, because the difference between the rich and the poor countries is actually increasing. And with the internet and communication technology, people can see that there's potentially a better life out there. And so I see governments that are becoming protectionist, reluctant to bring in newcomers, are probably going to lose the battle because they're not dealing with the supply side of the issue. And the supply side is huge. So you can't carry on as a government saying, oh, my country's the best place in the world to live in, and then not expect people to want to move there. So from a government perspective, I think these protectionist strategies, which are also my understanding from the economy and how capitalism works, capitalism only works when the economy is growing, the consumer base is growing and healthy and buying things. And when you're contracting it, you're artificially decreasing the profit that one can be made, if one could talk in those terms. I think the other issue is growing rates of conflict. So, you know, Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Palestine has kind of sucked a lot of the media attention away from other super nasty conflicts. Like I was just talking to a student this afternoon and she's from Haiti. It's awful. Like the person who's running Haiti, his name is Barbecue. We should be concerned about countries whose leaders are known by the word barbecue, which is the term to describe him burning women and children. And the fact that we can't get people out of Haiti and into safety is a huge concern. And we talk about the problems getting people out of Gaza. That's the same kind of concern. People are getting, they're being killed in front of us. And the world seems to just kind of shrug its shoulders and holds a few meetings and doesn't hold leaderships accountable. So increasing world conflict. And I think the other issue when we're talking about migration is climate change. There are entire nations that will not exist in less than 10 years. And they need to be resettled in big groups. Because if you resettle them piecemeal around the world, a few thousand here and a few thousand there, their culture and language is going to die. And we're talking like the United Nations, if they added people to their list who are in danger of being displaced because of climate, that 115 million would easily double. Because they don't count those people. Because if they did, I think the problem would just be seen as so enormous that people wouldn't want to do anything. And we're human beings. We have to look after each other. We breathe air. We share ideas. We share our art and our history and our culture. And it just makes me sad when I think about how the world just kind of doesn't care. Like, why aren't we up in arms trying to convince our governments to make violence stop and to deal with climate change? So those would be the three things I'm most worried about.
They're really big things, and I think you really articulated them very well. I was actually in Ukraine when Hamas attacked Israel, and the morning when that was actually still ongoing, and I remember I was walking down the street and we were talking about Russia had just killed 51 people in Kharkiv in a supermarket, civilians, and we were actually talking about that, and then I saw the alerts come on my phone about the Hamas attack in Israel, and I looked at my Ukrainian colleagues and friends, and I said, Ukraine's off the news for the next couple of weeks, and they went, what? It can't be. I think at that point, there was a couple of hundred people confirmed dead. Of course, the numbers ended up being much more horrific and much larger. But I said, look, this looks really bad. There's no way this is going to turn around and Israel will respond. And, you know, this is going to go on for a long time. This has really changed the international geopolitics, but also the media landscape, what news is going to get in. And this is when I'm talking to people in what is probably the largest and most well-known conflict of its time. As you said, places like Haiti. I mean, back on episode 36, I interviewed Joanna, a doctor in Haiti that I've worked with when I was living in Haiti. And, you know, we were talking about these issues, you know, the huge levels of crime, the sorts of crime, as you said, where people get nicknames of barbecue. I mean, this is not new. This was occurring when I was there, and it was occurring long before I was ever in Haiti. You know, the community justice and the tying people up and setting fire to them, you know, just the sort of crimes that we won't even talk about on the International Risk Podcast are still occurring. And the fragility of the Haitian government, again, is not new. It's never been a state that hasn't been fragile, except when it was being run by a dictator, which of course is not really the system of government we're going for, but it doesn't stay in the news for very, very long. And I think, you know, the same issue with climate. There gets a bit of a peak in interest around COP26 and COP27 and COP28, but then very quickly recedes. I think that is one of the biggest risks, that our attention and our ability to pay attention long enough to actually do something, as opposed to just being concerned about it and tweeting and then moving on, is a really, really big issue. But thank you for highlighting those issues. And of course, the rising economic disparity, which of course, globally, huge levels of economic disparity. But even within the European Union, I mean, if we look at Western Europe, countries like Germany, France, Netherlands, that have very high levels of GDP compared to Romania, Latvia, Bulgaria, that have very low levels of GDP. And then of course, even within countries, even within Sweden, you know, if we compare the urban to the rural, and then of course, migrant communities and First Nation communities, you know, there's such huge economic disparity. But I think you've listed off a bunch of topics we could have another 10 podcasts on. But certainly a lot of international risks, and nothing, shouldn't be feeling down necessarily about them, but being aware is certainly a step in the right direction. So thank you very much for coming on the International Risk Podcast today, Laurie. It's been great to speak with you.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Great. Well, that was Laurie Wilkinson. She's a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Manitoba. Today's podcast was produced and coordinated by Ben Lawson. I'm Dominic Bowen. Thanks very much for listening today. We'll speak again next week.
You've been listening to the International Risk Podcast, hosted by Dominic Bowen. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about this podcast. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week for your fix of risk-related stories.